This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Beware the Redwood Bureau, a secret organization which captures and researches creatures and objects that defy explanation. Their reckless procedures have led to countless innocent lives lost. I am Agent Conroy. I worked for the Redwood Bureau, but I have escaped them to leak their reports to the unsuspecting public. You have the right to know. Beware the Redwood Bureau, a secret organization which captures and researches creatures and objects that defy explanation. Their reckless procedures have led to countless innocent lives lost. I am Agent Conroy. I worked for the Redwood Bureau, but I have escaped them to leak their reports to the unsuspecting public. You have the right to know.
Redwood Bureau Report 6047. Typewriter. Ah, the old adage, be careful what you wish for. The idea that the things you want may not always come in the way you want them, or may come at a greater cost than you're willing to pay. No case embodies that message more than that of Entity 6047, a typewriter that appears to give its user exactly what they asked for. But, as they figure out all too late, at great cost that they have no choice but to pay, their time, their sanity, and to those unlucky enough, their life. The specific incident that we will be covering today concerns a young woman called Lara, who comes across the typewriter when visiting the house of its previous owner, a recently deceased man who gave Lara the first taste of fame that she had been chasing every day since. Inspired by his success, she resolves to continue his script and carve out a name for herself by whatever means necessary. And, well, it all goes downhill from there. Be careful when chasing your dreams, listeners. Wishes can be a powerful currency, and you never know what will be out there to grant them, and what they might take in return. Typewriter.
It was a few months ago when it started, but I feel like it had been brewing for most of my life. You've probably seen some of the stuff that I was in as a kid. My parents pushed me into acting pretty much as soon as I could talk. Mostly just adverts and one-off stuff at first. I landed the stereotypical, lovable, smart-ass kid when I was 11. And, well, after that I was hooked. I was popular for the first time in my life. Thousands of people tuned in to watch me each and every day, a number that I could barely even count to back then. I felt like a god walking amongst mortals, not quite old enough to understand the concept of humility, but old enough to have an ego the size of a building. And then I hit puberty. And, well, the smart-ass teen character is a lot less lovable than their child counterpart. The show only lasted for one more season without me, a fact that did console me, at first. Realistically, though, I knew that that kind of show, the suburban sitcom, just wasn't cool anymore. I just wasn't cool anymore, and it stung for a long time. What hurt more was how quickly my acting career dried up after that. I was an extra in a few movies, a dead body maybe once or twice, but that was it. I was just like everybody else. I was nobody. And don't worry. I know how incredibly full of myself that sounds, but it's true. That early tease of success left me feeling like I was destined for more, destined to be somebody that everybody knew. That's why, almost 20 years after the show ended, I didn't hesitate to click on the email that popped up in my inbox from the creator of the show that had first given me my brief glimpse of stardom so long ago. It turned out to not be from him after all, but from his ex-wife Sharon, who had inherited his estate. He had been found dead the previous week, hunched over his work desk a few days shy of his 68th birthday. His cause of death was unknown, but highly suspected to be self-inflicted. If he was going through anything like I am right now, I'm surprised that he managed to last that long. Anyway, he had kept a huge collection of set pieces from the show, and Sharon was inviting some of the actors into his home to buy some of the memorabilia before it was put to public auction. I went, of course. I told myself that it was to pay respects, but I barely ever spoke to the guy other than when we were acting together. He played the dad, on the rare occasions that the dad was in an episode. I always wondered why he didn't give himself a bigger role, as a kid. No, I went because I wanted a reminder that washed-up former actor meant that I actually was once an actor. Hell, maybe I could even pick up one of the old coasters from the show, or whatever I could afford off of a barista's frankly pathetic salary. I both was and wasn't expecting what I saw when my cab pulled up to the house. It looked weirdly like the house in the show, from the gaudy teal walls to the white picket fence surrounding the perfectly uniformed mowed lawn. It was a known secret that he was obsessed with the show. He spent every waking moment working on it, skipping award shows and dropping out of TV interviews at the last minute to continue writing his scripts. He stopped writing overall after the show ended against his will, publicly announcing that he would end his career in protest. I guess that's when he finally managed to settle down and start a family. I knocked on the door and Sharon let me in instantly, as if she had been waiting for me by the door. The look on her face was impatient, a fact further corroborated by the way she ushered me in. She cleared her throat, not meeting my eye as she spoke. "I'll show you around. You can take pretty much any of the junk for the right price, whether it's from the show or not. Most of it is. Coffee?" Sure, I answered awkwardly, craning my neck around to examine the house's interior. Sure enough, I could recognize a startling amount of furniture from the show, from peeling brown leather sofas to light fixtures that wouldn't have looked out of place in one of those prop houses they set up to show how the Victorians lived. There was a picture on the mantle of a fictional trip to Niagara Falls that we had taken together. Poor quality green screen made only more visible as I walked closer to it, wiping the dust off of it with my index finger. "That's the only picture he has displayed in the whole house. Did he know that he has three kids?" I jump, having forgotten that she was there. Or had. It's funny, he had everything. Wife ripped straight from the catalog, three kids, suburban house with a backyard, and a pool. Yet the only thing that he cared about in the end was his show that ended decades ago. Chained to this craft, I suppose. I get the distinct impression that she doesn't find it funny. "I thought he stopped writing," I reply, confused. "He started a new script a few years ago. I don't know why, but one day he just snapped. He kicked me out of the room to make it his office. Stopped talking to his kids, stopped being a husband. Became a shut-in. He relapsed, if that's the right word for it. God, the script is probably still on his desk." I was struck with a daydream where he had finished the script and casted me, letting me step into the limelight once again as a daring heroine or genius detective. I swallow, mouth suddenly very dry. "Can I use your bathroom?" Upstairs, to the left. I walk up the stairs and push open each of the doors until I find it. His bedroom turned office, the floor littered with cans and crumpled sheets of paper. It smelled oddly like a desert, the air arid and earthy. A thick blanket was nailed over the window, only one small beam of light escaping from the window to hit the desk. The desk was cluttered with more paper, loose sheets not arranged in any apparent order, forming a wreath around an old, faded typewriter. I pick one up and skim through it. It looked vaguely like a script, but without the proper formatting, lines of dialogue flowing freely from character to character with no proper separation. It was almost unreadable, but I pick up the page anyway. It looks like any other sitcom, I think. And that was enough for me to gather all of the papers on the desk and slip them into my bag as quietly as possible. She calls up to me to ask if I'm okay, as I turn to go downstairs. I step through the doorway when something stops me, twist around to give the desk a second glance. I pick up the typewriter and creep back down the stairs, walking past the living room as quickly as I can without detection. I crack open the door, and it only needs to make the slightest bit of noise before I give up and change tactics. Wrenching the door open and running down the driveway and onto the road, turning the first corner I see before I call another cab. In the car, I pull up my phone, emailing Sharon with an apology and a flimsy excuse as to why I left. We both know that a sudden bout of nausea doesn't explain a missing typewriter, but hopefully she wouldn't care enough to challenge it. For the first time in years, I began to actually feel hopeful. He was a genius at scriptwriting. All I needed to do was edit his script, and I just knew that I would be able to make something spectacular out of it. From then, I would sell it on to a director, who would graciously let me star in it, launching my career once again. I've been thinking of that a lot lately. Only now, I sell the script to whoever will take it and throw that typewriter into a fucking wood chipper. I use the money to skip town, maybe buy some pills strong enough to let me forget this nightmare. I got home and threw my bag on the floor, too guilty to even look at it. I was sitting on my bed, head bowed in my hands when I felt a buzz in my pocket. I took up my phone to see a text from my younger brother, Jack. Jack and I had only started talking again a couple months ago. The death of our father had brought us back together after nearly a decade of separation. We weren't particularly close as children either. I always got the impression that he was jealous of my success. He certainly made it clear how happy he was when I stopped getting roles. I couldn't tell you what that message said. Honestly, I don't think I even read it then. All that mattered was the reminder of what I had done this for in the first place, coursing through my veins like acid. I walked over to my bag and got the typewriter out. Sitting down, I got to work. His scripts were borderline nonsensical. Some scenes had no semblance of plot. Others introduced new characters who were never seen again. Every time I worked through a page, it felt as if three more were added on to the endless pile of word soup. I typed until my fingertips ached, until my throat stung, and my eyelids felt like sandpaper. And then I kept typing, until time didn't mean much of anything at all. I don't remember falling asleep. When I woke up, it was light outside, and I was still hunched over the typewriter. I checked the time on my phone and jumped up, horrified. I had been writing for almost 2 whole days. I looked around me to see the room covered with endless sheets of paper, the hardwood floor barely peeking through. I look at the time again and swear, grabbing my coat and running out, still in yesterday's clothes. It was Wednesday, meaning that I had missed yesterday's shift and was about to miss today's. I work, or rather worked, at one of those hipster coffee shops. You know, Eastbrook Mall? Yeah, the one right by it. When I started there, it was only part-time, so that I could still have the free time to do auditions. But, well, things didn't exactly go to plan. I started working full-time pretty soon, when I figured out that delusions couldn't pay my rent. My mind was split in half on the drive over. I wanted desperately to figure out how I could convince my manager to not fire me, yet I kept drifting back to that script, back to that typewriter. How was it possible that I could work for days without taking a break? I could barely remember most of it, but I could see flashes of pages upon pages, hear beats of incessant typing like a metronome gone rogue. My headache only got worse when I arrived at the coffee shop. I opened the door sheepishly, trying to draw as little attention as possible. I let out a relieved breath as at first glance the shop looked far busier than an average Wednesday afternoon. But, looking closer towards the serving station, I saw something strange. Workers were bustling around, sure, but none of them were actually doing anything. They were going through the motions, holding up mugs to the coffee steamers and feeding ice into the blenders, but no drinks were being made, no orders being taken. It was as if they were just keeping appearances, enough detail to be in the background, but nothing more. I tried to approach a coworker who had vaguely recognized, but I couldn't catch their eye. All of their faces were blank, staring straight ahead at their task or at nothing. Take a step forward towards them, raising my hand to tap on one of their shoulders. Lara, where the hell have you been? I jumped backwards, having to make a real effort to stop myself from flailing my arms as my manager appeared from the staff room. He gestures for me to follow him back into the back room with him. As I walk through the shop, I see a man typing furiously on his laptop, sipping on an empty cup of coffee. "Explain yourself," he says, not letting me sit down before he starts asking questions. "Explain yourself," he repeats, not even a second later, sounding even more furious. I stall for a second, confused, before answering. "I'm so sorry, I completely forgot that I had a shift." I lie, and his expression softens slightly. For a second, I think that I might be off the hook. "It's fine, Laura. Just don't..." And then he trails off, face going blank. I realize that he was no longer looking at me, but behind me, eyes empty and jaw slack. I turn around, but see nothing there. I turn back in time to see him nod, the movement so slight that I could almost convince myself that it never happened at all, that it was all some strange, creepy dream. The light returns to his eyes, and he looks back at me as his face hardens. "That's just not good enough. You're fired." I go to speak, to make excuses or maybe just to ask him what the hell is going on. But he cuts me off again. "You're fired?" he repeats, slightly quieter this time. The words make me flinch as I realize that he's looking over my shoulder again. I say nothing, but he tilts his head as if I've asked him a question, or perhaps given him an order. "You're fired!" he shouts so loud that I instinctively raise my hands to cover my ears. I stand up, chair clattering to the floor, slamming the door on the way out. I rush out of the shop, fear overtaking my confusion. The worker doesn't respond, and nor do the customers, back stiffly upright and eyes empty. I burst onto the street and lean against the shop front, suddenly exhausted. What was happening to me? Or to everyone else? That blank look that he had on his face. The one they all had. It was like they were following directions. And when he kept repeating himself, it reminded me oddly of when I was working on a set as a kid, having to do multiple takes of each scene. I take out my phone and realize that I had another text from my brother, inviting me to his apartment to catch up. I breathe out a sigh, straightening up. We had always had our differences, but we grew up together, and I needed to talk to someone about all of this. Whatever this was. The walk was long, but I needed the air. In fact, the sight of his front door made a new wave of anxiety wash over me, and I had half a mind to turn around and run home to continue my script. I had done my best to tune it out, but it had been a near constant urge since this morning, my fingers twitching subconsciously every few seconds. I do my best to shake the urge, not quite succeeding, and ball my hand into a fist, knocking on the door.
Warning, signal interruption detected.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
He swung it open fully upon seeing me, sweeping me into a bear hug. He nearly lifted me off of the ground with the strength of it, and I was taken aback by his uncharacteristic enthusiasm. I was further unsettled by the grin he greeted me with as he invited me inside. Jack didn't smile like that, not with his teeth. He never. I tried my best to dismiss the thought immediately. It had been a stressful day. I was just paranoid, whatever. But I know my brother. Officer, and something was very wrong. "What's gotten you so chipper?" I ask after he releases me. "Well, you know me, just being my usual self," he says to me, the same unwavering grin etched onto his face, not unlike a marble statue. The statement wasn't true. Jack was the stoic, quietly unaffected type. He pauses for a second before continuing. "So, how can I help you?" I look at him, confused. "You told me to come here, remember?" He pauses for a moment, expression unwavering. "Of course I remember. So tell me, what troubles you?" I wince, a dull pain starting to thump in my head. I hear a strange rumbling in my ears, but take little notice as I sit down, beginning to recount the strange events of the last few days. It was nice to talk about it. It took some weight off of my shoulders, at least. The headache came and went and came again. It was weird. Jack would say something and then pause for just a second too long. I would feel an ache in the back of my skull and my ears would thrum for a moment, similar to the noise of blood rushing, and then the sensation would go away when he started talking again. I stayed like that, talking to him for the rest of the day until I decided to head home. He walked me to the door with that same painful-looking grin and suggested that I get a train rather than walk home through such a dark evening. I agreed with him, and then I was gone, eager to curl up in bed and pretend that none of this had ever happened. The train station was only a few minutes' walk away. My jacket did little to protect me from the late night's chill, so I was glad to arrive so soon. I didn't even look up as I told him what ticket I wanted, too busy fiddling in my pockets to try and find whatever money that I could use to pay. In fact, my eyes only shut up to see the man behind the desk when he spoke, in a voice all too familiar to me. "That'll be $15. I choked on whatever I was planning to say next as I realized who it was. My manager, the man who had fired me no more than a few hours ago, only now with a beard and thick tortoiseshell glasses. I slam a note onto the table without thinking, my heart stuck in my throat. "Steve?" I breathe, and he looks at me with so little recognition that for a second I doubt myself entirely. That is until he leans back and starts to laugh. It was an ugly thing, the laugh. A poor attempt at a shrill, airy sound coming from a man with such a large frame and naturally low tone. I stumble back, shaking my head. He was making fun of me. They all were. They were all in on some big joke, and it was all at my expense. I ran onto my station just wanting to go home. I tried to distract myself by making a plan of what I could do once my train arrived. Once it picked me up, rode through the tunnel, off into freedom, I would arrive home and collect all of the sheets in my apartment, scrunching them into one big ball and putting it in the trash. Then I would find a hammer, or a knife, or whatever I could find, and make sure that no one else could ever recognize that typewriter for what it was. It was then, through my hysteria, that I noticed it. The whole station was lit up by these white overhead lights, and I was looking at the tunnel when I realized that the light was reflecting off of it. I do a double take, but it still makes no sense to me, as the inside of the tunnel was actually a flat wall. I was delirious by this point. I hadn't eaten, hadn't drank, hadn't barely slept. My lips were bleeding and red raw from how hard I was biting at them. My shoulders had been hunched so tight that it hurt when I tried to move my neck. I step onto the train tracks. I walk up to the tunnel slowly, cautiously, place my palm flat against the dark center where the train was supposed to ride through. Take me home through. It felt like cardboard with the slightest bit of give behind it. I lower my head to rest against it, eyes slipping closed. My only warning is a loud screech behind me before an overwhelming light hits me and I fall into darkness. I don't know how long I was asleep, how long I spent swimming in an endless pool of ink, backset by mechanical beeping and the acrid smell of bleach. I blink my eyes open to see a black mass inches away from my face. Focusing my eyes, I realize that it's a film camera. I don't protest. I don't say anything. I don't even move. I just lie there. I look around with only my eyes to see my hospital bed surrounded by nurses, some hooking up IVs and holding charts, others holding large cameras on their shoulders or long foam overhead microphones. I almost smiled, brought back cruelly to the source of all of this, my desperation to be back on screen. And that's exactly what this was, right? I was just a source of entertainment to them, and I was playing right into their hands. The door swung open and I began to hear that rumbling again, only now so much louder. Loud enough that I could finally place what it was. Laughter. They were laughing at me from behind the screen. They were all laughing at me. The doctor begins to speak, and the laughter gets louder. A nurse approaches with an IV and I jerk away, slamming my hands over my eyes. The raucous laughter and applause overtakes my thoughts. I wanted them to stop looking at me like that. I wanted it all to stop. You have to believe me when I say that I can barely remember anything after that. Little else but the pain of lunging out of the hospital bed with my injuries, the feeling of my hands around somebody's neck, and the phantom sensation of a needle between my shoulder blades. I guess that's why I'm here. I didn't mean to hurt him, officer. I just wanted some quiet. I wanted everybody to stop laughing at me. Please, go to my house. You'll see that everything I've said is true. Ask Sharon. She must have seen the same thing in her husband, I swear. Stop looking over my shoulder. Please just look at me. Why? Why are you smiling like that?
Lara was placed under psychiatric evaluation immediately after this report was given and was soon diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia. She was placed indefinitely under the care of Rooksmall Mental Facility, where she resides to this day. Her condition worsened after her imprisonment, and she was placed under higher security after an assault on two fellow patients. She alleges that the patients were filming her, however, no cameras or mobile phones were found inside the facility. Lara is now under 24/7 observation. Entity 6047 was taken into police custody and then quickly transferred to the Redwood Bureau for examination. Preliminary testing showed that 6047 was outwardly and mechanically identical to a standard typewriter. It was decided that one of the Bureau's interns should attempt to use 6407 for a maximum period of 3 weeks, with constant monitoring of both physical vitals and mental state. The intern appeared healthy in both senses until the 3rd week of the experiment, when they broke out of the facility to an unknown location, taking the typewriter with them. Upon rereading the produced written material from the entity, it was discovered that instructions on how to bypass high-level Bureau security were encoded into the material. The current status and location of both the intern and of Entity 6047 are unknown.
I'm Josh Tomar, host of Redwood Bureau. Thank you for listening. Redwood Bureau is a horror fiction podcast and part of the EerieCast podcast network. For more dreadful terrors, follow Redwood Bureau on Spotify and iTunes, and check out our other podcasts like Unexplained Encounters and Freaky Folklore on your favorite podcast platform. You can find me on Twitter and Twitch under username Tomamoto, T-O-M-A-M-O-T-O, and my voiceover is featured in a wide variety of your favorite video games, anime, and other animated shows. Until next time, don't forget, this world is a strange one.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.